Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the wonderful show that we have for you today. This is the Bob Darby, Advocate for the Homeless Mental Radio Show. And we are so thankful that Bob Darby opened up about the homeless mentally ill, that he meets here with us on Wednesdays to discuss the problems associated with being homeless and mentally ill. It's Bob Darby on the phone. I want you to know before I bring Bob Darby on that we have another host that will debut at the end of the Bob Darby show from 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Time to 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Bob Darby's Advocate for the Homeless Mentally Ill show is on the air. And then starting at 4 o'clock until 5 o'clock, stay tuned for the Miss Lillian Eagle Feather Human Rights Advocacy on this same channel. How exciting. We have back-to-back advocates talking to you about the issues affecting people, the things that they care about and that they want to make you aware of so that you will know and care about them too. And it's just really marvelous. My name is Mary Neal. I am Director of Human Rights Demand. You know, a very great abolitionist of the 1800s was Frederick Douglass. If you haven't read some of his speeches that he gave, you need to please go online and look up Frederick Douglass speeches. One of his quotes is that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. We are here every day at 3 p.m., except for Fridays when we meet at 6:30 p.m. And we are here for you to discuss issues that we feel you need to know about. And we're not just trying to recruit people and educate people, but we're trying to motivate people, energize people to get involved, to get involved. You are important. You know, a lot of people suffer from depression. Even people who don't have that disease of manic depression, they still suffer from depression, you know, because many people are laid off. Many people are, they feel that they're missing something that they should have by now, whether it's a special love interest or your career should move along faster or whatever disappointments you have. You know, we can dwell on our personal disappointments or we can forget ourselves and pour ourselves into something else, into someone else. And we will be so much better off if we do that. And I want to thank you right now for joining us on Human Rights Demand. Because, as Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never, ever will. And I want you to know that we value you as listeners, but you're of even greater value if you will just get involved. We have all sorts of needs in America, all sorts of needs throughout the world, and here we can help channel your energy. I don't care if you're in a wheelchair at home, you could do some telephone calling. You know, you could make some important phone calls that will show your interest and your support for certain things and make a difference that way. So no matter what you're going through, no matter what situation or circumstance you find yourself in, there are people who can be greatly benefited because you are. Yes, you know, God said he's the great I am. And I want you to know not only is he the great I am, but you are. You are here. You know, we often congratulate wonderful human rights workers who have finished their course. That's Martin Luther King Jr. I think of Frederick Douglass. I think of, you know, Miss Tubman. I think of Ida B. Wells, Ida Mae Wells, or whatever her name was. So many, there are so many people who have finished their course. And, you know, we often spend time looking back and giving great honor to these high achievers who have left their mark on the world, and they have gone on, okay? But this is your time. You know, everybody alive today, all 7 billion people, these are your contemporaries. And so you can make your mark on the world. You can do great things. You know, it doesn't matter whether or not you end up being a very high achiever like Martin Luther King Jr. You can be a person who just, you know, pours a little water on the seed that other people have planted. You can just do that. And we want to thank you right now for being willing. Hi, Bob Darby. How are you? Is this Bob Darby?
Hello, no. Hi. This is Philip. Philip Riley.
Oh, hey, Philip. How are you?
How are you? So where's Bob?
I'm doing great. Philip, I'm going to invite you to talk to the people about the human rights issue that you find closest to your heart at this moment while I call Bob on another line, okay?
Okay. Let me think. What's bothering me now, or what am I thinking about?
Go right
well,
ahead.
Lately, I was interested. I saw an article in a newspaper about some homeless person who had, you know, gone through some horrible problems, and I started looking. You know how one article leads to another article. I found your blog radio broadcast, and I said, "Oh my gosh, there's Bob Darby of all people!" And isn't it a wonderful thing that he's what he's doing? Not very many people seem to care much about the poorest of the poor and those people who are, well, you know, really in need of help. So, I don't know. It was a very nice thing to see your show. Anyhow, I'll confess, I'm kind of a normal person that doesn't really get too involved with you know, other things in the community. I was vaguely somewhat interested in Occupy for a while. We went to my son and my family, we went to these meetings, and that was hijacked, but you know, at least we you know, got out and did a few marches and were raising the question with people about, well, there's economic injustice. And this is a very rich country. It's wonderful. It's, you know, life for some of us is very easy. But, you know, it's you got to have a heart. I don't think people, they don't have the time, it seems, to care about other people. I don't know what the problem is. I think it's wonderful. I think we're just crazy, collectively. That's so vague. I don't know anything is the problem. I haven't seen Bob in like 40 years, and I thought I'd say hello to him and say, well, right on, brother.
Well, you know what, Mr. Philip? I just gave Bob a reminder call, and he said, oh, my goodness, this is that time. I'm calling in right now. I told him that you were on the phone. He's so excited, and he's about to call in right now. He had let the time slip him, and I'm kind of glad he did, because my audience knows that I have a tendency to run 2 or 3 minutes late. And I'm so glad to have you on the air. And I went to Occupy, too. I went to Occupy in Atlanta. Where are you calling from?
Las Vegas, Nevada.
Oh, wonderful. So y'all had Occupy Las Vegas out there, huh?
Oh, yeah. It was kind of horrible here. I don't know what the chapter was like there, but we got hijacked by Democrats, Libertarians, and Anarchists.
Oh, it was a total disaster.
Yeah. The guy that ran our website was this anarchist who got a hair up his ass and destroyed the website.
Is that right?
Yeah. And then there was this other group formed called Occupy for Everybody or something, which was actually a front for some local libertarian politician. It's a shame. I got all prepared to go out and when President Obama was coming to town, I was going to go out there and say, hey, what's the deal, you know, with Timothy Geithner and all this, you know, this bail us out, you know AIG, well, you know, that was important, and Goldman Sachs,
so,
yeah, I guess they're important, but what about the people, you know? Anyhow,
feel like the Occupy Las Vegas wasn't as effective as some of the chapters were.
No, not at all. Not at all. And so, anyhow,
Mr. Bob Darby is on the phone right now. Mr. Bob Darby, you're on the air.
Yes,
How are you?
Well, hello,
okay,
who am I talking with?
Oh,
this
hello,
is Bob Darby.
Philip Riley.
Philip, I called in a little late. I just let time slip by me. So what's going on out in Las Vegas?
Philip Rainey from Las Vegas.
Nothing at all, except we're hot at the moment. It's very hot. You don't remember me, do you?
Do I?
Bob.
No. So what's your last name?
Riley.
Food Not Bomb?
Riley. What?
Philip Riley. That name sounds familiar.
Forty years ago, I was like this. Well, since you're talking about homeless people, I was a runaway living on the street, and I knew you in Atlanta in 1969, and I met Bill and Joe Strober and Bill Bray and Buddy Powers, and then I met you and I remember going out in Lloyd's Carmen Ghia and. I don't know, just hanging out.
This is really a long time ago. This is like the early 70s.
Yeah, 1970, 71. And then I left town.
In 69, I was up north. I was in Boston in
69.
I could have met you when I was visiting Atlanta because I'm originally from Georgia.
Yeah.
But I was living in Boston until... late 1970.
Oh,
I moved back to Atlanta.
I met you through Bill and Joe over at their house once.
Joe Strober. Wow, I haven't heard his name in a long time. Joe and I kind of drifted apart. I mean, we didn't have any kind of hostile parting or anything like that.
Yeah, right.
Are you still in touch with him?
I just never called him again. What?
You haven't been in touch with him either.
No, as a matter of fact, you can't find him. He's covered his tracks really good. I'm sure the NSA could find him, but, you know, you and I, my brother's a bail bondsman. I went and used all these weird services that he subscribes to that generally gives you the ability to just, you know, look up anybody. And I can't find any evidence of him living or dead. Really strange.
How did you... Yeah, how did you find me? Just
I was looking at some. I was reading an article about some homeless man, and you know, the links, you know, led to other links and other articles, and then I thought, oh my gosh, there's this Blog Talk Radio with Bob Darby, advocate for the homeless and mentally ill, and I said,
That's right.
I know that guy.
Yeah, well,
and,
that's amazing, isn't it?
Well,
what
wonderful.
Are you doing that in Vegas?
I'm kind of retired now. Nothing.
Yeah, so am I.
Fixing up my house, mostly. And
how old are you?
60. Should I tell you? 61.
Yeah, I don't know what mine is. I'll tell you, I'm 69.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm really
so
old.
There,
I'm pushing 70. It is old. It is old.
And yeah, it's
I'm retired as well, and I did Food Not Bombs for 16 years in Atlanta.
Oh, my gosh.
16 years, and I pretty much quit doing it about year and a half, 2 years ago. I just kind of burned out, and there were a lot of factors involved. But,
yeah.
Also, the cops, the police are really coming down on people serving food in the parks and in the streets.
Yeah, that's really strange. That's not just in Atlanta. These rich people, they don't want to see homeless people, you know. They don't, you know. They
no,
might be reminded
no,
of some crazy relative of theirs, like their own son or daughter, who's probably living on the streets or who knows what. You know, people don't
That's
know.
Right.
These people out on the streets could be anybody's son and daughter. And even if they're not,
wow.
And even if they're bad people,
wow.
Most of them are people you don't want to talk to and are really awfully problematic people. People, you know, it's just a matter of, like, humanity that...
Well, it sure is.
We take care of them. I remember when I knew you, I had just gotten out of a mental hospital.
Right.
And I thought it was horrible that people could be, put in a hospital against their will. And about that time, the laws changed. And, you couldn't really, it wasn't that easy to put people in a mental home against their will. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean.
And within a few decades, we have a lot of these people who really should maybe, you know, we should be able to have a judge or a board of medical people say, well, yeah, this person really can't take care of themselves.
That's right. Take care of them. Absolutely. Well, I worked at Georgia Regional Hospital for a couple of 3 years.
Yeah.
And I also worked in Boston in a little hospital. I have a degree in psychology and blah, blah, blah. And a very large percentage of the population is one of the things we talk about on Blog Talk Radio, does
mm-hmm.
suffer from some serious mental illness. It's like, according
mm-hmm.
to the National Institute of Mental Health, about 3% of the American adult population that's 18 or older have
mm-hmm.
either schizophrenia or bipolar disorder.
It's amazing the numbers. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's about 10 million people, you know, out of 310
yeah.
million
yeah.
population.
We've got millions of people in a coma right now. You know what I mean? It's, you know,
yeah,
well, not
yeah.
millions, but you know, hundreds of thousands of people all over the country are in a coma. Are we going to throw them
know.
In the street? You know, we have people born with spinal bifida, for crying out loud. We don't kill them.
Well, not yet. You know, we don't. That's
not
right.
Yet,
it's
yeah.
a death sentence. It's a virtual death sentence to completely ignore someone who's desperately sick and to abandon them to the streets. It's like death by torture. It's not
yes,
just a death
it's,
sentence.
It's, yes, because a lot of people who have, like, bipolar disorder or whatever. I'm not a psychiatrist. A lot of people have peculiar things that they must do. I'm thinking of an autistic person that I know. He has to eat a certain way. He has to
right.
go, he has to do things in a certain order or else he freaks out. He gets, you know, really crazy, very, very upset.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what that must be like if you don't have the means to do those little ridiculous things that you need to do to live.
Well, that's
but,
just more obsessive compulsive type behavior. But I mean, that people who have one mental illness very often have symptoms of others too. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And,
well, then, yeah, there's people that are hallucinating right now. Hallucinating.
That's right. Millions of people
are not there.
I know.
And,
I know. And, you know, it's just as cruel to throw somebody out on the street who's hallucinating and who has schizophrenia or bipolar or some other severe mental illness, for that matter, even depression or panic disorder or PTSD. It's just as cruel to abandon them to the streets as it would be to abandon somebody with, say, Parkinson's disease or multiple sclerosis, or like you said, a coma. If somebody is not given the help in a coma, they'll just die within a short period of time.
But someone that's cruel, actually, to put them out on the street.
Well, they won't. They won't put somebody. They won't. You know, I've never heard of anybody with Parkinson's disease or multiple sclerosis or Down syndrome or any number of different brain-based illnesses, which mental illnesses are. Because one day they can be treated with successfully with medication. But you know, I don't have a PhD in psychology, but I have a BA in psychology, and I have a year towards a master's and blah, blah, blah. You know, you don't have to have a lot of academic training to understand or to have a good understanding of what people who are mentally ill are going through living on the streets. I mean, if you've been in a mental hospital or if you've worked in one or both or whatever, You know what it's like. You know, you've seen it. You've witnessed it.
Yeah, it's pretty bad in there, too, but it's a lot better, I think, for a lot of people that they're there and not on the street.
Well, I'm an advocate of hospital.
Excuse me, Bob Darby and your guest. I want you to know that we have on the phone a great advocate for homeless mentally ill people. He's from Fresno, California. His name is Reverend Floyd Harris. And he hosts the radio show National Network in Action, where I have my Assistance to Incarcerated Mentally Ill show every Wednesday night. He's on the line right now, and he'd like to give some input regarding homelessness as he sees it in Fresno, California. Hello, Dr. Harris. How are you?
Good evening, Sister Neal. How are you and the good folks that are on the line this evening?
Well, hello.
Well, you have
fine. Thank
on
you.
The
Thank
line with you. You have on the line with you, Dr. Harris, Bob Darby, who is a great advocate for homeless people, and also his friend, Mr. Phillip?
Oh, Riley. Hi. Hello.
Mr. Riley.
Yeah, Phillip Riley.
This is Reverend Dr. Floyd Harris. Go ahead, Dr. Harris, and tell us. I'm letting him speak to you now, Bob, because he has to go back to work shortly, okay?
Yes, Michael. Okay. Thank you, Sister Neal, for giving me a few minutes. I don't have a lot of time, but you know that any time you call on me to do something, I always want to be able to show my support, not by just lip service, but by physically being involved. My name is Reverend Dr. Floyd Harris Jr. from a town called Fresno. I have changed the name of Fresno to Mississippi Fresno because of the conditions that people are oppressed in the city. Those of you know what happened in Mississippi to Emmett Till, that's the type of philosophy mindset that we have here in Fresno. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, yeah, fine.
Okay, but for those who are listening to the show, please visit YouTube and type in Reverend Floyd D. Harris Jr. Please go to my Facebook, Floyd Harris Jr. Also, National Network in Action Facebook. Also, Rev Harris Blog Talk Radio. And Google my name and see the different movements that we've been involved with here in California as well as across the world. Fresno is a place here where we have probably over 15 to 20,000 homeless people that's on the streets right now. This city here, the politicians rolled the dice to invest the money that came from HUD, from Washington, D.C., to pay those into salaries to people at City Hall, for streets, for the flippers to build different projects that has went under. Our homeless people here are under siege right now. They try to build homeless encampments to where they could have a place, a safe place to go. Our city of Fresno, our mayor, it started with Mayor Alan Autry, the brother who played on Heat of the Night called Bubba. He was our former mayor for 8 years. He's the one actually started the raise of camp in Fresno. It grandfathered into the mayor that we have now, who was termed out. She has continued to destroy the homeless encampments. When we start talking about funding for mentally ill, all funding has been cut. I was almost 80% here in Fresno. So our mentally ill, there are really no services for them to get any type of treatment. I also believe that the and I didn't say that I was the assistant pastor of New Light Church of God here in Fresno, California. My senior pastor is Pastor Paul McCoy, who's been pastoring for over 32 years, very conscious and civil rights, social justice mindset pastor, and it's just a wonder to serve up under him and learn all his wisdom. I believe, gentlemen, and to Radio Land, that our churches today have been co-opted by the government to be silent. I believe that they're getting subsidized by, it could be money, or it could be by different services that's going into their churches. And that's the reason why you don't see many ministers like myself who is not going to go in the back room and talk to politicians, but come out into the community and talk to politicians and have a public discussion on why the conditions of our community across the country are in the shape that it's in right now. Our police department right now here in Fresno has raided, torn down Caltrans with bulldozers. Just please, when you have time, just type in Fresno, California, homeless encampments or whatever search engines you want to use, and you will see all the different videos on YouTube. Type that in, and you will see tractors tearing down encampments, and just, you know, people have nowhere to go, no hope.
Reverend Harris,
yes, sir.
Same thing's happening in Atlanta. The police have been bulldozing Atlanta encampments in this city as well. It's happening all over the country, some places worse than others. I've heard, actually, of the persecution that's going on the of the homeless in Fresno. Here in Atlanta, I mean, it's. Have you heard of Food Not Bombs, Reverend Harris?
Food Not Bombs, yes, sir.
Food Not Bombs, in which I was involved for a good many years, about 16 years, until recently. I'm retired. I'm almost 70. I'm 69. And Food Not Bombs has been involved in this, and I know for a fact that in Atlanta, every time the homeless have the courage to try to set up an encampment in however obscure a place, the police will find out about it and they'll send in the bulldozers and they'll bulldoze encampments. So it's getting to where it is against the law to be homeless, and they're enforcing it.
What America have to understand is that since time, that America has to continue to keep poverty in the state of mind that it's in. It's big business to be in poverty. It's big business to tear down encampments. It's big business to make sure that mentally ill patients and those in the community do not get services, because then if they don't get services, then the police comes and pick them up, arrest them, and now you got another situation where the police and the county is making money off of those who are not getting services. So it's a domino effect. If you don't deal with one, you deal with the other. And so I'm not going to take too much more of your time. I'd like to come on maybe next week when I have more time, but I just wanted to introduce myself, and I was listening to you all conversation. But I will say this, is that, you know, we need to make sure that we are out in the trenches that's doing what needs to be done in our community. Don't wait on nobody else to do it for you. Much as I love Dr. King and all his work and Malcolm X and Thurgood Marshall and Megan Everts, we can't wait for another one of them to rise. We have to rise right now ourselves and learn from them, learn from the blueprint that they have left here for us today. And all we got to do is stand on justice and truth. The motto of National Network and Action is that we educate, motivate, energize, organize, and mobilize, and take our community to a higher level. And our people in the community right now do not see us being transparent. They don't see us out there. When I say us, I'm speaking to myself because I need to do more of it, is that we have to be consistent with our message. We have to be consistent in building capacity. We have to educate our people and understand that you have, and I say this, and many people disagree with me, but Dr. King even said it. He said that you have to be willing to die for what you believe in, because that's the ultimate price that we're going to have to pay for justice and liberty and quality in America. And so when you look at the civil rights movement, you will see that those folks back there, my ancestors, understood that they had to sacrifice their body, their soul, and their mind for us to date, for us to even be talking on the phone right now on Blog Talk Radio. And so I say that, Sister Neil, and I have to go. I hate to run, but I just want to say thank you for giving me this time. Please research our work. Please come on, listen to our shows all through the week. We have shows every day of the week. And Sister Neil, I'm going to go ahead and turn it back over to you.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you very much, Dr. Floyd Harris. You really gave our ministers something to live up to. We need activist ministers. We need everybody involved, not just the religious community. We need people in civic organizations. We need people in the American Legion halls. We need people to stand up together, united, and make a human rights demand on behalf of the homeless, mentally ill, or the homeless, period, whether they're mentally ill or not. We need to make a demand so that they will be given shelter. How can this nation send troops all the way to Africa to find 200 missing women, and we have women right in front of them who are wandering around homeless? You know, take care of home first. That's what I think is important. What do you think, Bob Darby?
Well, I agree with that 100%, and I certainly think it's important to extend charity and to extend rescue operations overseas. But when you consider the fact that there are as many as a million mentally ill people living on the streets.
I got to go. This is a long time I've been on the phone. Can
okay,
you all hear me?
Yeah, I can hear
yeah,
you.
Yeah, we hear you.
Yeah.
Well, thank
Philip,
you.
There's a lot, you know, that could be said, you know, but.
Thank you for joining us.
I really wanted to call Bob. You know, Bob, I can't find your phone number in the
Let me give you my phone number, okay? Let me give it to
yeah.
you. 404-622-5859. And let me give you my email address, too.
Oh,
it's
great.
Bob Darby, 917 at yahoo.com. And I really
oh
would
gosh,
like to talk
Yahoo.
To you some more.
About yeah.
Darby.
You know, Yahoo's not a very secure email, but whatever.
Okay, well call
but
me.
That's
then.
Good.
They'll call me on the,
no,
well,
no, I'm going to email you and call you. I'm
going
to go to your
fine.
Website.
Do you remember Tony Knox, by the way?
Yes. Healthy.
Well, Tony and I are still close friends. I still see him. But that's another thing. We're not here to talk about personal things.
Yes,
amazing,
yes, right. I'm sorry. Yes. You know, I used to work in a prisoner's project. We used to get people jobs before they got out of prison. You'd think
that's
people
wonderful.
Would be interested in things like that. There used to be a lot of grants that you could get just, you know, doing useful things.
That's right.
I hope
and
you
now
can get some money or something to extend what you're doing to other people. You and Mary both, you know, of course,
well,
we need to.
The activist scene here in Atlanta is
yeah.
alive, but it's not nearly as alive, and it's much more discouraged than it used to be. Because one thing I want to point out is that, you know, the word, the expression homeless, mentally ill was not even in the vocabulary 25 years ago. And now people don't bat an eye when you talk about, you know, hordes of sick people living on the streets. What has happened has been this society has just been horribly brutalized. And it's true all over the country. It's like the man in Fresno. It's like he sees it. It's like you in Las Vegas. You see it. We see it in Atlanta. We see it all over the country. You know, the idea is that there's just a diminution or a lessening of compassion and sympathy for other people who suffer. One more thing, you know, I'm going to say this for the audience and saying it for you. I've done research, I've written articles, blah, blah, blah. The first people that the Nazis killed in great numbers, the first people were the mentally ill. They set up gas chambers on the grounds of mental hospitals and crematoria on the grounds of mental hospitals before they extended them and started killing millions of other people, the Jews, the Gypsies, the homosexuals, all the other groups that they hated. Before they started doing that, they killed off the mentally ill. The very first people that are, it becomes socially acceptable to despise and to regard as subhuman, historically, are the mentally ill. And that's what's happening in this country. And I think it's a very, very scary, very dangerous symptom of where this country is really headed. It's headed towards something really awful if we don't change course. But get in touch with me. I'd like to talk with you personally because we undoubtedly have things to say. And I'm so glad that you called in, Philip. And I'm beginning to, you know, bells are beginning to ring, and I think that we can strike up some more conversations later, okay? Phil, are you still there? Mary, are you still there?
Yes.
Oh, you're still there, okay.
There's something wrong with this telephone connection and all. I do have a lot of things to say about work that I did a long time ago about, you know, with mm-hmm. the homeless and prisoners. But,
okay.
You know, it just, I don't think it's really relevant to what you guys are doing. But,
we're just trying to stir things up, Phil, really. I mean, what we're doing personally.
I think, like, things have always been horrible. You know, hopefully we're evolving as a people to something better. But, you know.
But you know, there have been times when there was more hope than there is now.
Right. Yeah, there's like these waves, and lately, oh my God, you know, like I was trying to say, if the newspaper USA Today has an article on the homeless mentally ill, it's probably because it's getting to be so noticeable that these rich people who, you know, are these upper class people who are bothered by such sights, you know, might take an interest.
Well,
but,
they take an interest if their own daughter or their own son or their own husband.
Oh, they can't conceive of such a thing. They have no idea that such a thing is happening.
But they have to have such an idea because it's about...
Some people do, yes. But a lot of people don't even know that their son or daughter is off on, you know, living on the street somewhere doing something crazy. They have no idea. Most, if you look at a typical American family, there's not really that great communication between people.
No.
They don't keep in touch.
What I'm saying is that mental illness and drug addiction and alcoholism and all of these symptoms of so-called social pathology, they're everywhere.
People hide it.
Hide it as much as they can. And what happens now is that, you know, you probably remember a recent case in which I believe it was in Illinois or, you know, maybe it was in Kentucky. But anyway, a legislator's mm-hmm. son could not get mental health services, so he attacked his father. You remember hearing about that?
No, he did what?
He attacked his father because his father, who was a state legislator, is that right, Mary? Was his? Mary knows more about it.
That was in Virginia, Bob. That was a senator.
Tell Philip about it. Tell Philip about it.
It's horrible, but it sounds funny too. You know, it's ironic.
But anyway, he killed himself. But anyway, what happened is the state legislator was in Virginia, could not get help for his son. It is so hard for people to get mental health services these days, that they go berserk. And this young man went berserk, and he attacked his father with his knife. Didn't kill his father, just injured him. And the son subsequently killed himself. So that's what is going on. It happens at all levels. I mean, you don't have to be poor. You don't have to be in a so-called minority group. You could be, you know, rich and privileged and still... You can experience tragedy, mental illness, or alcohol, or addiction, or anything in your own family. And it does happen. But like you said, people don't like to admit that it can happen to them or to their family. But it does. And that's what is happening, is that such people are being, when it does happen, it's being hushed up and it's being marginalized. Mary, would you talk about that a little bit, about the incident in Virginia? I think you remember it better than I do.
Well, thank you, Bob. Yes, this happened, I think it was during or right before the holidays last year. that Gus Dietz, who was the 19-year-old son of the Senator Dietz from Virginia, he's a state senator. Senator Dietz took his son to three different mental health and all said that they didn't have beds for Gus Dietz. They didn't say he wasn't in need of help. They said they didn't have bed space. And so the senator's son ended up at home with him, and he kept on having his mental health crisis, and he attacked his father. He sliced his face. He cut his, he stabbed his neck, and Senator Dietz got away from him, his son Gus, but in the time it took the senator to get ambulance services there, that young man had killed himself. He stabbed himself. And so Senator Dietz has now filed a lawsuit for wrongful death against the state of Virginia. So that is the latest in that, that now the state of Virginia, who they did not have a bed space for a young man who was in mental health crisis, they caused that lack, caused his death. And also we know that they lied to the senator. They did have bed space available. That came out right after the young man died. They're so used to turning people away that they turned a state senator away that was experiencing mental health crisis, even though they did have inpatient beds available. And that is very tragic, and the senator has filed suit. And I think it is important for us to know that that suit will be paid, and it will be paid more than likely out of our tax money. So we have not saved any money by relegating the mentally ill to prisons and jails, which really costs more than community care. We have not saved any money by paying $80 billion a year for our prison budget, and 1.25 million of the people in prisons across this nation are mentally ill people. We have not saved any money, but we have made life very difficult for any number of families. And when I say families, I'm telling you, it affects the whole family when your most vulnerable members have been jailed, and you know they're sick. That affects the whole family. And so we have a bill in Congress called the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act. And it was put forward by Representative Tim Murphy, who is a Republican out of Pennsylvania. And we really want to support that bill, H.R. 3717. It provides for continuous monitoring of people who have severe mental illness. It provides for them to have AOT programs, which are assisted outpatient treatment programs, so that they can be treated in their homes and communities. They would have mandated appointments to keep with their psychiatrist, and they wouldn't have these mental health crises. But what happens is that the mentally ill are allowed, to decide for themselves whether or not they want treatment. And that works out for people who have light cases. It works out for people who are experiencing distress. But if you get a person who's schizophrenic, bipolar disorder, or what have you, and they're already in the middle of a mental health crisis by the time the police get there or by the time the ambulance get there, and if you ask someone who's already having a crisis if they want treatment, the answer will always be no, because by that time they're hallucinating, and to them you might look like a green Martian. So why would you leave it up to a sick person to let themselves get in that situation? I think that everybody who's exiting prisons and jails, as well as hospitals for mental illness, needs to be put on an AOT program. The ones who, if you put them on it when they're stable, they will remain stable. And I think that's the point. I think that's why they don't use AOT programs as much as they should, because they want to make this prison investment money. What do you think about that, Bob Darby?
Well, I think you're extremely articulate and right on target, Mary. I agree with you 100%. That's what Ifo Lettori, who is a very prominent and outspoken advocate for the mentally ill, recommends, the assisted outpatient therapy program. And it would save money to the public. But like you said, the prison industrial complex depends on the infusion of the mentally ill into the prisons and jails because of they're privately productive, or they're privately profitable to those who invest in them. I mean, we have a system in which people are getting rich off the misery of many. And about 40%, according to the New York Times article that I sent you and that I've talked about in the air a lot, about 40% of the people in prison are mentally ill, about 40%, to some degree mentally ill. Some are severely mentally ill, a great number. They don't break them down into the actual different categories of mental illness. But about 40% of all the people in our prisons suffer from some mental illness. Well, these prisons are a huge industry. They're an industry for the government. They're an industry for private concerns. And that's by a lot the reason, and I think that you were talking about that yourself, Phil, that it's a big industry. It's a big money-making scheme. So we have to expose that, and we need to demand that more money go towards opening more mental health, public mental health facilities, more beds, more doctors, more social workers, more group homes, instead of this constant trend of shutting down facilities. And in Atlanta, they're doing the same thing as you're talking, the reverend from Fresno was talking about. In Atlanta, they are shutting down all services, public services, for the mentally ill. They're shutting down homeless shelters. They're shutting down the Jefferson Place Men's Shelter. They've already shut it down. They're shutting down the Springdale Women's and Children's Shelter. They are, instead of expanding the services for the most in need in this society, they are actually contracting them. So that's the situation we're faced with, and we need to protest as loudly as we can and to enlist as many people as we can to try to challenge this atrocity, because that's what it is. This is an atrocity. So thank you for fleshing out the question I had about the young man and his father from Virginia and that tragedy. That kind of tragedy is happening all over the country, and it's reflected in these occasional, you know, mass killings we have of people going berserk and killing people. It's because of the failure of our mental health system. It's because of the prison industrial complex. It's because people don't want to turn around and face their own problems, and the problems of mental health incarceration, mental health homelessness, are the problems of everybody, because it's the entire society that suffers when the society turns its... So are you still there, Phil?
I am still here. No, your friend is not with us anymore. He might be listening via computer. But I agree with 100%, Bob. The situation is that I think we don't have but one problem, you know. I don't think we have 20 problems. I think we got one problem, and that is that jails and prisons have been privatized. They're in the business, like anyone else, of getting more new commodities. That's the business they're in. They want to get more new commodities. And you want to get commodities with long shelf life. So they're getting young people who have mental illness. They're getting young men, young women who are under 25, who, and putting them in jails and prisons long term. So this is the situation. And they look at what goods and services they can make difficult to ascertain so that they can guarantee themselves fresh stock all the time. I think that they see our mentally ill loved ones, neighbors, friends, as being in a slave pool. I think they see them as being in a slave pool, and they go
fishing whenever they need to, and they fish out new commodities. So I know several families right now that are having mental health crisis, and their crisis has nothing to do with their mentally ill loved ones getting out of hand. Their crisis has to do with trying to save their children, their grown-up young children, from the slave catchers. They have the same problem as the African villages had back in the day. And these people are not all Africans. One young man is black, Terrell Scott. One young man is white, Mark Bowles. These people are actually being lied on in the criminal justice system to excuse taking these people away from their loved ones, away from a stable environment where they are living comfortably and stable, and they're trying to put them in the prisons at your expense. That's the game. And so I ask you to go to Dog Justice for Mentally Ill, Dog, D-O-G, Justice for Mentally Ill, and read about the individual families having mental health crisis. And as I said, the crisis has nothing to do with the people being sick and out of control. The crisis that they're experiencing is the people in the criminal justice system who want to entrap their young ones. They want to entrap young people. The younger, the better, because they can, once they go to jail, they keep adding more time to their sentence, and so they can keep them for life. I know one young man who went to jail because they say he did an assault while he was at the mental hospital. Now, this is something that never used to happen. A mental hospital called the police on an inpatient. You know, so even the mental hospitals are calling the police on inpatients. I think they're all prison investors, and I think that privatized prisons and jails is 100% of the problem that is happening regarding the mentally ill. They're homeless because they don't try to provide them shelter. As long as they're homeless, they hope to arrest them one day for vagrancy or panhandling. It's all a setup so that individuals who are prison investors can make money off of our Americans who have disabilities. Understand that these are Americans with disabilities. Most of the people who have severe mental illness and who reside in a home have been declared disabled. And they may even be getting Social Security for a disability. But the American Disability Act does not seem to work to protect people with mental illness. You know, Americans with Disabilities Act has declared it illegal to discriminate against anyone for reason of a health disability. But it's like in small print someplace, it says mentally ill people accepted. That's the exception to the Americans with Disabilities Act. I have any number of families who've called on the Civil Rights Division of the USDOJ for help, and they won't help. They will not care about people with mental disabilities. That's an exception to the Americans with Disability Act. They get no protection. They get no special treatment that they deserve and that they're supposed to have, because they are deliberately being left for the prison investors. The private prison system is the most protected system in America that I know about. The private prison system. I can't even hardly write an article about them without these stalkers coming out the woodworks and interfering about it. But I did manage to put together a good selection of articles. These are human interest stories. And I hope you will take it as more than that. I hope you will take it as a call for help because, you know, as I said at the beginning of the show, everybody is
is prone to feeling a little down sometimes or a little ineffective, or you feel like you're not getting fulfillment from your job. Maybe you work in a warehouse or someplace like that, or even in an office, and you seem to be doing the same thing all day and it's not really challenging to you. I urge you to take on the challenge of helping us advocate for mentally ill people. And you can start just by writing your representative and asking them to support H.R. 3717, and that is the Helping Families with Mental Health Crisis Act. You've got to start someplace. So I urge you, after you listen to this show today, and we have another show coming on right after, Ms. Lynn Eagle Feather, after you listen to these shows today, don't just say, they told the truth there. Don't just agree with us. That doesn't help anybody, really. What helps is if you get the link and share it with your online groups. What helps is if you go ahead and type in right elected officials. And when you put in your zip code, they will bring up, you don't have to know your congressperson. They will bring it up. And you can write a little email, and they will receive it. You know, the mentally ill don't usually vote. So it's important for us who are out here and we're voters, it's important for us to let our elected officials know that we care about the homeless mentally ill and about the mentally ill in crisis. So please do that. Please communicate with your elected officials and let them know that you care about the issues that we present here. And you can feel free to mention that you heard about the H.R. 3717, Helping Families with Mental Health Crisis. Just go ahead and let them know you heard about it on the Bob Darby Advocacy for the Homeless Mentally Ill. Bob, what do you think about that? Shouldn't more people get involved?
Is somebody else trying to speak on the other line? I hear someone right coming in. Is there anybody
yes,
else on the line?
Yes, someone else did come on the line. I think that's Ms. Lynn. But I was asking you, Bob, what do you think about our audience? What is their responsibility? When they hear us talk and they learn about the problem, is it not their humane, is it not their just simple responsibility to contact their elected officials and let them know that they care about these issues? Wouldn't that help?
Absolutely. Absolutely, and you're giving us, including me, some very good advice about how to get in touch with them through the computer. But I have written my personally, I've written my congresspeople and complaining about it, and they didn't write me back. But I think that's a good first step is letting them know that we're concerned, and talk it up just generally among people you know, and you know, try to stimulate interest and outrage even. So,
absolutely.
You know, and tell people about and Google it. Yes, Google these concerns, but not everyone uses computers. Another way of finding out about services is the United Way. I mean, I know the United Way isn't perfect, but you can dial 211 and find out about how you might become active in protesting and changing the system as it is, as it relates to the homeless, incarcerated, mentally ill, and the homeless, mentally ill, period. So there are a lot of things that can be done.
Absolutely.
What, Mary?
And again, all they need to do to learn about specific cases, petitions to sign, elected officials to call, is go to Dole Justice for Mentally Ill, and there they will learn about a number of families that are experiencing mental health crisis. And again, their crisis is that the system wants to remove their most vulnerable members and jail them over false arrests. And I want you to go there and read about that. Read about the deaths of the mentally ill. So go to Dog Justice for Mentally Ill and become aware of these things. And I want to say this, and then we're going to bring on Ms. Lillian Eagle Feather. And I want to say this. You know, we have a political party that has a reputation
that they built themselves through advertisement of being the political party that cares about the indigent and the middle class. We have a political party that claims to be the champions of the poor and middle class, the working class, and that's the Democratic Party. But I want you to know that the Helping Families with Mental Health Crisis Act bill came from a Republican named Tim Murphy. And I also want you to know that very few Democrats have co-sponsored that bill. I believe that we've got a major problem. I believe we've got a tremendous fraud going on in that a good many of your prison investors, a good many of the politicians who are actually preserving our mentally ill people untreated in order to arrest them are Democrats. They are your so-called white liberals. They are your so-called black brothers. High five. I want you to know they're capitalizing, or they're at least preserving our mentally ill people untreated so that they can be used for capital. And I want you to look at the list of co-sponsors for that bill, and you will see very few black representatives. You will see very few Democrats at all. And I want you to ask yourself why. In Atlanta, Georgia, which is largely a Democratic area, we have a Democratic mayor named Mayor Kasim Reed, and most of the people on the Fulton County Commission are probably Democrats. I want you to know that the Democrats have given themselves, they've assigned to themselves the slogan of the party that cares about the poor and working class. But I tell you that this same city of Atlanta, the same Fulton County Commission, where probably most of the people, I'm sure over 75-80% of them are Democrats, I want you to know that they have closed, they're closing down the homeless centers, and they are kicking the people in the street, men, women, and children who are homeless. Meanwhile, they've opened in Atlanta an international center for human rights. Bob, have you been to the International Center for Human Rights downtown Atlanta yet?
No, I'm aware of it, but I have not been to it. No, I haven't. Don't they charge to get, is there an admission fee to get in?
$15. You know, it's $15 to walk in the door.
Oh,
so, you know,
that's ridiculous.
Nobody homeless will be able to go in there. It's the International
Center. Well,
nobody
poor. I mean, nobody, $15
poor.
Is, you know, that's a couple of meals or three meals, you know. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Well, Bob,
a lot
we
of
want
people,
you to,
that's a lot of money.
Bob, we want you to please invite the people back next week, and you stay on the line as long as you want, because Ms. Lillian Eaglefeather is going to start her show right now. So go ahead and tell
good.
The people how they can contact you if you want, and also let them know when to come back and hear you some more.
You talking to me?
Yes,
Mary, you talking to me? Okay, sure. Well,
yes,
well, you know, I don't mind giving out my my email address. It's bobdarby917@yahoo.com. That's my email address. If anyone wants to contact me on my email address, please do. And you know, I'm trying to do what I can to stir up interest in this and to find a way to help the people on the streets, find a way to help the people who have been unjustly incarcerated, because for no other reason than they are mentally ill or because they're addicted. People who are addicted are almost always, or I would say always, have some kind of underlying mental disorder, or they wouldn't have gotten addicted to substances or alcohol in the first place. So we're developing a society that is very, very harsh and very cruel and criminal in its character when it actually profits from incarcerating people and putting people out on the street. So please contact me if you want to. I want to hear what Ms. Eaglefeather has to say. So let me turn it over to you, and you turn it over to Miss Eagle Feather, okay?
Well, thank you. And I'll invite everybody to come back every Thursday at 3 p.m. and listen to Bob Darby, advocate for the homeless mentally ill. Bob Darby, advocate for the homeless mentally ill. And now we have Ms. Lynn Eagle Feather, who has a new show that debuts today, and it is called, for now, Lynn Eagle Feather, Human Rights Advocate. Ms. Eagle Feather, how are you today?
I'm just fine, Mary. How are you and Bob?
I am doing well.
I would like to start off the show. My name is Lynn Eagle Feather. I'm from the Rosebud Chichongu Nation in Rosebud, South Dakota. And I would like to start off my first show with a prayer, the Native American prayer. O Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the winds and whose breath gives life to all the world, hear me. I come before you, one of your children. I am small and weak. I need your strength and wisdom. Let me walk in beauty. Make my eyes ever behold the red and purple sunset. Make my hands respect the things that you have made. My ears sharp to hear your voice. Make me wise so that I may things you have taught my people, the lesson you have hidden in every rock and leaf. I seek strength not to be superior to my brothers, but to be able to fight my greatest enemy, myself. Make me ever come to you with clean hands and straight eyes, so when life fades as a fading sunset, my spirit may come to you without shame. That is a beautiful Native American prayer that we say at my Wellbriety meeting that I go to. And also, I wanted to also start my show with a little poem that sounds like this is the way that the people used to live, the Native Americans. I know this show is on our people. It says, I am home now. Come on in, my friend, to warm your hands. Come on in, my elder. You have all my respect. Another day has passed. Rest here if you are tired. Come on in, my sister. Bring your little one. Eat my fried bread. I made it for you. It will bring you strength for your little one. Come on in, my brother. Your moccasins are warm. Here, have mine, so you can continue on your journey. Do not let the poisons pull you from your path. May people come on in. Let us talk and smoke together. For you are forever welcome in my teepee. And that's the way the Native Americans used to live back in the day. You know, if somebody was journeying through a community, they were always welcomed in and gotten fed without any expectations of being, you know, we didn't have money. So maybe they would leave a blanket or tobacco or, you know, barter. We would barter. But now I want to let you know a little bit about myself. I am a 57-year-old Native American woman from Chichongu Nation, and my first encounter with homelessness was when I was 4 years old. That's the first time I slept outside. We slept in an abandoned car. I was abandoned by my biological mom after my father went to prison at the age of 5, and I remember the hunger. We would eat bread with ketchup or bread with sugar, and we never had no running water. We had an outhouse, no toys, no electricity, and I was left alone with 3 smaller siblings, and so I had to grow up real fast, and I became a little mother at that age. I remember washing my brother's diapers and hanging them up, being left alone with them, and being scared. And I could fry an egg at the age of 3 and a half. That's what age I was taught how to start taking care of my siblings because my parents were alcoholics. Taking my first drink around 4 because there was nothing to drink. We had no running water. And I became a ward of the state for 10 years, living in abusive homes and group homes. And I started running away, and I was became on my own at 15. I ran away, and I got my GED when I was 15. I went to a junior college in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's called Southwestern Indian Polytech Institute at the age of 17. And at the age of 18, I went to University of Nebraska without anybody's help. This was all on my own. I've worked through every pregnancy. I have three children. I worked through every pregnancy except my first one. That's when I was going to University of Nebraska. I became a mother at the age of 18, and I became homeless with my children, which when they were little, which was very difficult. We would have to go to shelters, stand in line to find some place to eat, and finally, I sent them to a boarding school, which was in Riverside, Anadarko, Oklahoma, which is an excellent school. I thought it was better for them. It was more stability. And I became homeless and sleeping out on the streets for the first time 11 years ago for 3.5 years. I slept in the rain, the snow. On a New Year's Eve, it was snowing hard, and I would... it was hard looking for a place to eat, clean up, hide my few belongings that I did have. And I would cry and sit by a church and pray and talk to my deceased father and sister. And I would ask them to watch over me. I know I'm still here today, so they must be watching over me. I took care of my ex-boyfriend's grandmother. And I started going to the Native American Talking Circle. And the boyfriend's grandmother was 93 years old. And I treated her as if she were my own grandmother because I never had one. So I took care of her and loved her and treated her as if she was my own. Let me see. I was holding her hand while she took her last breath. So I call her my angel, because she helped me to sober up and take care of her. And that's when I started going to the Native American Talking Circle. And I would hear about these men having homes, and I asked them, who do I talk to? And I had to admit that I had a problem with alcohol. And when I did, and filled out papers as to what experiences I went through, being homeless, being raped, being abused, my clothes being taken from me, rocks thrown at me, squirrels throwing their pine cones at me early in the morning. but I was housed within a month, and I was so happy and blessed and have been housed for 6.5 years now through the Coalition for the Homeless. You have to go through a tiered program of going to groups, going to see your case manager. And I graduated within the 2 years with a certificate. And now I'm telling you this so you can have... No, I'm telling you this so you don't have pity on me, but to show you how I came up from nothing. There are people out there who have it worse. And I pray for them every day. I pray for the ones on the reservations who are suffering the most. I'm grateful for the Creator for blessing me in the many ways that He has. I'll never forget where I came from. Nowhere. From the ground. So now I am here with you today to talk about the statistics of our people, our people's homelessness. So you can email me at LynnEaglefeather, one word, at yahoo.com with your stories or questions. Colorado Coalition for the Homeless has a wonderful program here for the mentally ill, disabled, groups for dual diagnosis, of course, NA, Native American Talking Circle. And Wellbriety, because without my sobriety, I wouldn't be here today on this program. I just want to say I'm glad I went through what I did, because it made me the strong person who I am today. I have the Creator, Tungashala, to thank for that. And I went to the Indian Center yesterday, which is half a block from my home, trying to get statistics of all the homeless families that go through there. And they just brushed me off. You know, I said, here I am trying to help people in exposing how many homeless Native American families we have here in Denver. And they wouldn't give me no information. I contacted people at the coalition. They didn't get back to me. They got back to me with the statistics of all the homeless people here in Denver, but not of the Native American. I Googled it, and I found out that, I have my paperwork here. I found out that this is through the, there's a gathering place. It's just for women. 47% were Caucasian, 11% are Native American, 1% Asian, 1% Hawaiian. And that's just at a women's shelter. 20% of the youth are Native Americans that are homeless in Denver. 11,061 people in Denver alone are homeless. And that's, I think this was last year, this was taken. And Native American homelessness is 1.3% of all the homeless people. And 29.5% are addicted to alcohol and drugs. 16.2% have mental illness. 8%, this is from being homeless, I mean, because of their homelessness, just due to their homelessness. 8% are just coming out of jail. 9.9% are from domestic violence. And so it goes to show that we have a great problem in the city. I came through, I was honored at a dinner today, a little luncheon, I should say, and drove 15 miles to get to where I had to go and came home. And I couldn't believe all of the new buildings that are going up in that 15-mile radius from my home to where I had to go. And thinking, why can't they do something for the homeless people? They are building all these brand new condos along I-70, along the highway, down by the stadium, for all these yuppies. But yet, our people, you know, not only my people, all the homeless people are suffering. They are building the bridges. The people used to sleep under the bridges. Now they're building them at an angle where nobody could sleep under there anymore. They're banned camping here in this state, where you cannot, if they find your stuff, they bring a big old truck and they throw all your belongings away. They are now going to start banning, I think they passed a bill where they're going to start banning flying a sign where people ask for money. So I believe that the crime rate will go up sky high after they do that. Or, you know, because what are they going to do? There's no jobs. Maybe for their mental illness or their addiction problems. Because, like Bob said, you know, the majority of the people that do drink, well, you know, are dependent on drugs, have some type of mental issue that they need to take care of. And mental illness runs in my family due to the trauma and abandonment that we went through as children. And being raised in very abusive foster homes, I was in a group home where I was put on psych drugs. I think it was called Ellapil. And they had every one of us kids on a psych drug, so they could control us And when we got out of hand, they would throw us in a closet with a little mat, and they had control of the light, how much light we could get in. There was no windows in there. It was just like a closet. And if a kid was having an issue, a problem, they would call the other house parents to come. And I've seen children being dragged in there by, like, animals, like a pig. You know, one would have their feet and their arms. And this was, it was very traumatic to see this kind of stuff when I had just come from a beautiful foster home that I was in. These people were very good to me. And to see this kind of behavior traumatized me. I have a PTSD, probably from the hysterical trauma that my parents went through. Being taken from their parents and being forced into boarding schools. They were forced into school. Their hair cut, their language, they couldn't speak their language. They were beaten for that. So when I was growing up in these homes, we were forced, they would shave our hair. We couldn't have long hair because they said it didn't look good on little Indian girls. And that's, I think, you know, they say our spirit is in our hair. And to this day, after I became an adult, I have never cut my hair. My hair is pretty long. And just for that purpose, they would tell us if we wanted long hair, we would have to curl it. And, you know, we have straight hair. We don't have curly hair. If the Creator wanted us to have curly hair, we would have had curly hair. So, going through these different types of foster homes, we would never know when we were going to move. The only way was if when we came home from school and there would be three little boxes, one for each one of myself and my two sisters, three little boxes of our clothes, probably a couple change of clothes, and that was it. And that was the only way that we knew we were going to move. We never knew where, to who. And so it was very traumatic. So I suffer from these problems today. I have anxiety attacks, panic attacks. I had one this morning because my brother, who's alcoholic, has been, he's on a drunk, and, you know, being an alcoholic myself, I don't want it to be around me, and I try to help him, and I can't do any more for him. He's got to help himself. And so I've done a lot in helping people from the community, the Native American Talking Circle, taking people home, mostly try to help women who are in maybe an abusive situation, who don't have anywhere to go. I've also helped a person that my son met, an older guy. He was a veteran. He was from the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma. And I helped him. You know, I said, is he going to be trusted? My son said yes, so I let him come in. He spent the weekend here. He was so grateful because it was pretty, the weather was bad. And then I was getting my grandchildren for the night, so I told him he had to leave, because my grandchildren were coming, and they spent the night. And then the next day, my grandchildren got picked up. It started snowing, and I had made a big dinner, and I thought, gee, I wonder what happened to Randy, where that man is, you know, if he's okay. So right next door to the Indian Center, which is a half a block, there's a bit abandoned building where all the homeless people sleep. So I got dressed out in the snow, went out there, and I found him laying there with a little tiny blanket. So I told him, Randy, come on, you know, you don't have to be out here in the snow. You know, come on, I just made something to eat, and come home with me, and, you know, you can warm up and have something to warm in your stomach. He called me later on and told me that he was so grateful for helping him. I sent him to the Native American Talking Circle, and they helped him put him in a motel, got him a motel voucher since he was a veteran and an elder at that. So he got help. He got off the streets. And the people at the Talking Circle, you know, they talk highly of me to other people. I didn't know this. But they said that, you know, there should be more people like me in the circle, because there are some people that don't want to help, want help. There are some people that don't want to admit they have a drinking or drug problem. So therefore, they stay homeless. They are just bouncing around from people's houses and couch surfing. And I know of several people, you know, that are like that. They just don't want the help, I guess. But not me. I wanted my own place. You know, when I was so grateful and thankful, and I pray every day to the Creator, I give thanks for my home. I smudge, I burn sage, I smudge myself, my whole home, and that's a cleansing for, of our people that we do. And I am just, I'll never forget where I came from. And this is why I do that. And I am so grateful and honored to be on this show today. I put it out there on Facebook. I don't know how many listeners we have called in today, but it doesn't matter to me how many are listening. You know, it's coming from my heart, everything that I'm saying today. And I wanted to also read. We have seven virtues among the Lakota people, and this is a virtue we have to the Creator. As an Indian person, I realize we make no gains without the Great Spirit being in our lives. Neither I nor anything I attempt to do will work without our Creator. Being Indian and being spiritual has the same meaning. Spirituality is a gift from the Great One. This day, I vow to walk the red road. As an Indian person, I will return to the traditional and spiritual values which have guided my ancestors for the past generation. I will look with new eyes on the powers of our ceremonies and our religious ways, for they are important to the very survival of our people. We have survived and are going to grow and flourish spiritually. We will fulfill our teachings and the purpose that the Creator has given us with dignity. Each day I will pray and ask for guidance. I will commit to walk the red road with dedication, for each of us can do these things when others will follow. Then others will follow. From this day forward, I will reserve time and energy for spirituality, seeking to know the Creator's will, which I believe is the reason I am here today. And thank you very much, Mary, for giving me this time to speak on this issue, because I have been homeless most of my life, and it's a healing process for me to be able to speak on this. And sometimes when I read, I just read this. I took notes and I read this. And when I do talk about it, it doesn't seem like it happened to me. It seems like a dream, a bad dream. And so, you know, I'm just very grateful that I could get past that, that I don't dwell on that and use alcohol and drugs to mask that pain. This is helping me tremendously to be on these shows. And I just want to say thank you so much for giving me this time and space. And hopefully people will call in. And I was wondering if anybody has called in yet. Mary?
Oh, I'm listening to you, Lynn. And what a beautiful message of love. That's your whole message, is saying love, love, love. And I'm reminded of the scripture that says, love ye one another
as I have loved you. And I want you to know that your life, to my idea, has turned into a beautiful, beautiful song of love, love for your fellow man, especially for your fellow Native Americans who might be going through distresses. Many of them are from the same cause that you went through distresses, because I read that in 1972, the U.S. Senate had a study conducted to find out how many Native American children had been displaced from their reservations and their birth families. And it was up to 35% in 1972. That's more than one out of every three Native American children had been removed from their own families and from their own reservations. At many of those Native Americans suffered, as you suffer, from the separation anxiety, from having been displaced from their families and from their loved ones and from their communities. And this is an ongoing problem among Native Americans. It's as though there's a concerted effort to destroy the continuation of your culture. And I am so glad for you to come on Human Rights Demand and make a human rights demand on behalf of all people, but especially Native Americans, that these people, these children, if any way possible, they deserve to be with their own communities. They deserve to stay a part of their own families. And if this is still happening, we make a human rights demand right now that you see. Please look at what it did to Ms. Lynn Eagle Feather, to be separated from not only her family, who were, her mom and dad were into alcohol abuse, but also her community. We ask you to please, if children must be separated from their biological families, that you try to keep them, place them with other Native Americans in their same communities so that they will not have to experience a total break from their own culture and from their schools and from their friends. It is best if children have a sense of continuum in their growing up years so that they won't feel so dejected, and especially because it's real that they are not just experiencing thoughts of rejection, they actually are rejected very often in the foster families where you place them. I believe that it was Ms. Lynn Eaglefeather who told me that she and her sisters had to eat separate from the foster family who they lived with because they were Indian girls. And they ate something different from the families they were eating with. They might be eating burgers, but the Native American children were eating something different. They were given less expensive dinners, less expensive lunches, whereas the people who were getting paid for their care were eating what we used to call in Tennessee high off the hog. The people who were getting paid to take care of these little Native American girls ate high off the hog in the dining room, while the Native Americans were not deemed suitable to join them at the family table, and they were eating comparative scraps when you compare it with what the family who had their care, who were getting paid for their care, were eating. This is very damaging to children. And I believe the system knows it. I believe the system knows it. You know, we talk about so many things. For instance, Black history. We talk about Black history as though the lynchings, as though the slavery went someplace. It all disappeared someplace. But it hasn't. You know, we have got to face the fact that we have the same problems, the same oppression that happened 300 and 400 years ago is happening now, but it's less obvious to those who will not look,
The Bible says there is none so blind as those who will not see, those who refuse to see. That, yes, we still have lynchings in America. Read the newspaper. Black killed by police officers continually. And last year, a great many black people were killed by Caucasians on the street who were not even police officers. When you heard about Trayvon Martin, that was certainly not the only case of a person being killed by someone who was not a police officer. Yes, we have lynchings still happening to African Americans. We have children, Native American children, who are still being separated from their birth families and their communities. We still have these problems where they're telling the Native Americans, don't speak in your language. This is what they told African Americans when we came here as slaves. You cannot speak your own language. So these things were happening to Lynn Eaglefeather years and years and years after slavery supposedly ended, you understand. But it's still going on. So when we talk about the cowboys and Indians, we talk about it as though it ended in the 1700s and 1800s. And it did not end. The war just went undercover. When you talk about the Old South did not go anywhere. It just actually spread out, and now it's, the whole nation is the Old South because black people are arrested, whether guilty or not, whether the charges against them have any validity or not, they are arrested wholesale and used for free prison laborers. So these circumstances are happening right now today in the United States of America. Guilt or innocence are not really considered when the prison system opens its mouth to swallow up somebody. I'm telling you that many people, I think most of the people, who are under arrest today are there from plea bargaining. They never had trials because it didn't really matter to the system whether or not they were innocent or guilty, just that the prison system opened its mouth. It pointed its finger at this person or that person and crooked its finger, come here, you. And then they levied charges against the individual, whether the charges had any validity or not, knowing that they could pressure that person who didn't have sufficient income to get a good defense attorney, knowing they could pressure that person into signing a plea bargain and getting what they call less time as opposed to if they press for their right to a fair trial, a fair and public trial with a good defense attorney appointed to them. So what you see on television that depicts the criminal justice system is very false. It doesn't really happen like that. It doesn't really, crimes are not really investigated that thoroughly. They're not. For instance, in Georgia, we had a young man, Mr. Johnson. He was, I think, 17 years old. He supposedly fell and bumped his head when he was reaching for a tennis shoe, and he died and didn't come home that night, of course, because he was dead. And the police didn't really investigate that, you know. They didn't really investigate it. They gave the parents back his body after some time. None of his organs were there. None of his organs were there. So black people and probably other people, too, are being used. Being killed and used for their organs. So these things are happening. These crimes against humanity are happening right here in the United States of America in the 21st century. You don't have to go back to the 18th century. We don't have to go study Black History Month and say we live in the age of colorblindness now, because we do not. Ms. Eaglefeather, I wanted to ask you, when you were reading the statistics of the homeless in Denver, is that right?
Yes.
It seemed like you didn't give any figures for the African Americans. Were there no African American homeless in Denver?
Yes, there was, but I was having a hard time. I don't have a computer. I was on my phone, and I had a rough start this morning. I had a procedure yesterday, and my brother was hounding me on the phone, so I have a rough day today. But I will get some more statistics on that for on the next show. But I would like to read you some more statistics, if I could, before we leave the show.
Absolutely.
Do
you have 17 minutes.
Okay. It says 10% of all Native American families are homeless, over 14%. The rate of Native homes without electricity is 10 times the national average. This is all across the United States. 25% of Native households lack running water. Unemployment rate on some reservations can be as high as 75%, while the infant mortality rate is about 300% higher than the national average. Life expectancy of a Native man is 50 years old. One of the top 20, including the poorest counties in America, are all on Indian reservations. Suicide of Native youth 10 times higher or more than the national average. 1 in 3 Native American are raped in their lifetime, 86% of which are committed by non-Natives. The sad truth is that only a handful of policymakers give Native American priority on the national agenda. So we need your help to bring this ugly truth of America to the real truth of Indian country. And you can call 202-456-1111 for comments. I think that's the White House. And another number is 202-456-1414. That's the switchboard. And another number, 202-456-6213 for more comments. Or you can write to the White House, 1500 Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20500. So that's with the last of my statistics that I had prepared for today.
Well, Lynn, you have really opened my eyes. I had no idea that things were that critical in Indian country. I had no idea of the suppression that Native Americans are living under. It is absolutely traumatic, the things that the Native Americans still endure in their own land, their own country, the USA, or in other words, Turtle Island. This is really unacceptable. You know, Lynn, tomorrow is the 4th of July. Tell me what the 4th of July means to Native Americans.
It means that nothing to us. It's not us a holiday. I don't celebrate it. I don't celebrate Thanksgiving. These are not holidays to our people, as this is, we were oppressed and on these days, and it's nothing to me, you know. It's a day of fireworks, and the next day it smells awful. That doesn't mean anything to me or my people.
You know, Lynn, until I got more familiar with Native Americans, through you who came in touch with me on Facebook, I'm very recent. As my knowledge about Native Americans' oppression is very recent knowledge. The thing is that I thought of Native Americans as being almost extinct, and the few that were still alive, I felt like were living quite high off the hog with their casinos. I thought that Native Americans were basically rich now with their casinos and the large acreage of land that had been set aside. Some nations got reparations payments. So there's this perception that Native Americans are okay now. But that perception is wrong, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Pine Ridge Reservation is the poorest in the nation, Pine Ridge Reservation. They have the highest suicide rate. It was in Wyoming. Riverton, Wyoming has a high suicide rate amongst the youth. And also I wanted to say that I own land in South Dakota. So when I was homeless, it was very ironic because those cows that's being leased out to non-native white farmers. And when I was homeless, I would think to myself and I would cry and I would say, gee, those cows have a home to sleep. They have somewhere to sleep and I don't. And that's my land. Our reservation, you have to live on the reservation in order to get casino money, which isn't very much. I received a check one time in the mail from the government, from the BIA, for $1.15. They send me paperwork as far as when the leases are up on my land. They try to send me paperwork on selling my land. But I have never sold any. I recently inherited my biological mother passed away about 4 years ago, and I inherited her land. It's a state law, federal law now. They were dividing the land up before when someone passed like that, but now it goes to the oldest because the land was being so fractioned up in little bitty small pieces. That they're just giving it to the eldest, which was me, which I would have rather had a set of parents than that land. You know, I would have, because all the trauma I went through, I would have rather had parents any day and have some land where I can't even go up there and sleep on it, you know. But I guess now I'm going to go back and learn because I was raised with non-natives. I felt like I wasn't wanted by the non-natives or by the natives. I felt like I was lost. I still do at times, you know. I'm barely becoming comfortable with going to the powwows because before I wasn't. I got out and danced at a honor song for the veterans powwow for my father, who was a Korean War veteran. And they have the highest rate of enlisting in the Army. Native Americans are the highest rate of people that enlist are Native Americans. And some people think that we don't belong over there, but that just goes to show that they don't want to be on the reservation anymore. They want to do something, and they're fighting for this country who did wrong to them, who did wrong to our people. They are over there fighting and losing their lives. Lori Paestua was the first woman to get killed in Iraq. She was from the Hopi Nation. And Jessica Thomas, I forgot her last name, but they were together when Lori got killed. And they promised, they made a pact with each other and promised each other that if I die, you take care of my family. If I go, you take care of mine. And I saw it on that Extreme Home Makeover where Jessica went to Lori's family, a new home built for them. Her daughter had a horse, had horses, and they had a new corral made. It was just an awesome show. I wish I could see it again. I cried through the whole show, you know. So our Native people are, you know, they're warriors. And they're still fighting and struggling. And I'm one of them, I could say. You know, I've come a long way. And I am just so honored to be here today with you, Mary and Bob. And thank you very much for having me.
Well, you deserve to be here with us. I am very humbled to hear about the things that you have experienced that I would not have known about had my own brother not been secretly arrested in Memphis Shelby County Jail and kept 18 days under secret incarceration. I don't know whether they did medical experiments on him, used him for waterboarding training. I don't know why they hid this mentally ill, middle-aged heart patient for 18 days in Memphis Shelby County Jail and then murdered him and delivered us back his naked corpse without any explanation or inquest or anything, denying us to even know how he died or why he died. That's why I say, Lynn Eagle Feather, that lynchings still are happening in the United States of America. And you don't have to do more than just pick up a newspaper to read about the lynchings. The thing is, though, that I'm very discouraged that so many Native Americans are committing suicide because they don't see their prospects in Turtle Island as being that great. I say to you that you should have stronger resolve than that. I say to the Native Americans that we need you. If you feel like your life is useless or hopeless, then you know what? The problem is that you are concentrating on your own problems too much. We need you together with us, and we all concentrate on working together to make this world, to make Turtle Island what it should be, home to all of us, where we can live in peace and harmony, where we can have our human rights and our civil rights respected. And that can't happen if you give up and kill yourself. That can't happen if you give up and just go drink yourself to death, get psoriasis mm-hmm. of the liver. You know, when a person drinks, their brain actually shrinks and the grooves in their brain deepen. They actually get brain damage, traumatic head injury from overdrinking. It's not just your liver that's affected by overdrinking. Your whole body is. And I think that Native Americans had lived such a pure life in this country with pure water, fresh air, fresh vegetables, fresh meat. Everything in the world that they wanted, they didn't even have to plant crops. They would just, some of them were nomad tribes that would just travel from one area to another when the weather got bad. They would go to another area where this was in season or that was in season, and then they'd go back. There was no need even to do a lot of agriculture because they owned it all, and they would move around, and they respected each other so much that there were no jails mm-hmm. at all in Turtle Island.
Mm-hmm.
No jails whatsoever. These are people of high honor, high respect, and we need you. Don't kill yourself. Don't kill yourself by a gunshot. Don't kill yourself with a knife. Don't kill yourself by police. A lot of people do death by police. They do things that they know the police will shoot them, and they do it so they can end it all. Don't kill yourself with drinking and drugs. Give us your life. Give your life to the Great Spirit. Let him use you. If you're through with your life, if you're through with it, then please give it to us. Please call me at 678-531-0262. My name is Mary Neal. I'm channel director here at Human Rights Demand. Say to me, Mary Neal, I'm through with my life. So what do you want me to do with it? Because I'm through with it. Instead of killing yourself fast or slow, give us your life. Give us the opportunity to show you areas of need that we can direct you to, areas of need that you can fulfill the need. And you will get help at the same time. Help us to help you, and you use your energy to help the next person, and that's how we pass it on. We got to pass the love on. Don't sit up and bemoan your fate. Don't think in terms of your mom or dad who you used to love, and they separated you from your mother and dad, and now they died, and you don't have a family. All of those thoughts. You know, the Bible says, and whether you're a Christian or not doesn't matter. I use the Bible as a philosophical book, as an instructional book, as well as a spiritual book. The Bible says that whatever things are good, whatever things are beautiful, whatever things are worthy of praise, think on these things. Now, you heard Ms. Lynn Eaglefeather say that she just came from a luncheon where she was honored for her humanitarian work among the Native Americans. I want to congratulate you on that, Lynn. I want to congratulate the people there at the Talking Circle and your other friends for recognizing when they're among greatness, because you are a great woman. You are a great lady. You are elder of your tribe. You are great. You're setting a great example for other people. And when you feel despair, when you feel, you know, the Bible says don't get tired, don't get weary in well-doing, because eventually all of your efforts will pay off. I pray that God will bless your brother, God will continue to bless your son, and that most of all, God will continue to bless you, Ms. Lynn Eaglefeather, as you continue to work for him and show his love to your people. Invite others to call this station at 347-857-3293. And listen to Ms. Lynn Eaglefeather and listen to our other guests starting at 3 p.m. Ms. Lynn Eaglefeather comes on at 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and I ask you to transpose that into the right time where you live. And join us, because we have work to do. We don't have time to give up to the bottle, give up to the needle, give up to the marijuana, give up to the gun. We don't have time. We need you. We need you. And so we ask you, brothers and sisters, who are Native Americans, who are indigenous people, who came from strength, we ask you to make a strong resolve that, no, I'm going to keep on keeping on. I'm going to stand up and be what God made me. God made me a great person. God gave me a great people. And I will use the rest of my life to uplift them. Go ahead, Ms. Lynn. You have 30 seconds.
I just want to say, Pilamine Tukashila, for having me, for giving me the strength and courage and wisdom to do this show, to help other people, to have friends like Mary as a guidance in my life. She has been very, very great to me, and I just really appreciate that, Mary. And thank you, all listeners, for listening in. If there's any out there, I hope you join us next week. I'll be on next week with more statistics and maybe different stories.
God bless you.
God bless you, too, Mary and Bob.